new to neighborhood church with us, one of the things you maybe notice is that you guys read a lot of scripture before the sermon. That's an old tradition. It's often called a lectionary. We don't use a lectionary. We pick the passages that we read every week. But part of why we do that is that we just think it's wise to regularly hear God's word and then saturated it in it. Hopefully you can hear, but all three of those passages, we'll briefly touch on each of those as we go. It's about wisdom. That's our vocab for today. This series, which we started, I don't know how long ago now, maybe 4 months ago, it's called The Grammar of Faith. I knew we could begin a week out, and we'll talk about it, but it also did in there, so right here. First, if you were here last week, I'm going to let you down. I'm not staying at the beginning of this sermon. That's not happening whenever I'm here, and you can thank God for that. If Damaris comes back, that would be great if it does. That's not happening with me here. It was so great that Damaris here last week. What we usually do, and we're going to do it again today, is we take a vocab word. Today it's wisdom. But we also talk about how do you not just define what this word means, but how do you use it in sentences, so to speak, grammar? How do you connect it to the rest of life, syntax? And wisdom is a great example of why we're not just defining vocab words and telling you the right and true things to believe spiritually and theologically, but we're trying to focus on how do we use these in our lives. If you have ever thought about this as you're reading through the Bible, and this is not unique to the Bible, this is true in almost every culture in the history of the world, the Bible uses two words together and separately a lot. It can be very confusing if they're the same, if they're different, and if they're different, how are they different? Knowledge and wisdom. Knowledge and wisdom. They show up together. Here are a couple of ways to think about the difference. First, it's from a very famous, not a Christian, although because his European is very influenced in the 16th century by Christianity, but a very famous essayist that many of you heard of, Montaigne, French humanist. And Montaigne has a great line distinguishing the difference between knowledge and wisdom. He said this, and I'd love for you to think about this. Whereas I can be knowledgeable with another human being's knowledge, I can never be wise with another human being's wisdom. You can come and listen to a thousand sermons here in the years to come. You can participate in the Christian community. You can be in the midst of everything we're doing, and none of it guarantees that you will become wise. You will almost certainly become knowledgeable more than you are already if you're just listening to what's happening and paying attention, but none of it necessarily means that you will become wise. I think almost every culture has some form of this cliche, this idiom. In American English, I love it. It's so the older I get, the more profound it is to me. There is no substitute for experience. There is no substitute for experience. You can read books all day long. You can pay attention as long. But you are not wise unless something in addition to knowledge happens. And if you want to turn to me, we didn't read it, but Proverbs is a place we'll be a lot today. Go back to Proverbs. Go to chapter 26. I was going to do this later, but let's do it to start off with it. To give us a framework for thinking about wisdom as a category. Here is one of my favorite places in Proverbs, and when I'm teaching on how to read the Bible, this is a passage that I come to a lot. Wayne knows, maybe you've noticed it before, maybe not. Proverbs 26, verse 4. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him in yourself. If you're scrolling down Twitter, and people are saying crazy dumb stuff, don't look. Doors bump. Don't get in that. Just walk on by. Do not answer a fool according to his folly. If you are constantly responding to all of the stupid things people say in the world, you will soon enough become a fool yourself. You'll have a quick temper. You will constantly be reacting, and other people will be setting the agenda for how you spend your time and what you spend your life on. So that's a great form of wisdom. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him yourself. But the problem is the next verse. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest you be wise in his own eyes. Answer a fool according to his folly. Sometimes you gotta speak up. Sometimes you can't be silent. Sometimes you have to speak up and say, that's not right. That's stupid. That's going to hurt people. That's hurting you. That's not true. That's dishonoring to God, whatever it is. And here's the thing, and I want you to notice a couple of verses later. There's a reason. One of the things that often comes up is not how to read Proverbs today, but we can do that in the future. If you read Proverbs, it looks like somebody's thrown darts at a dartboard. And there's just a bunch of individuals saying, there's some truth to that,
But there's also something really not true about that. There are groupings of sayings, proverbs, and they often come back to similar themes. And I want you to notice that in verse 7 and verse 9, these are not accidental that they're here. Like a lame man's legs, which hang useless, is a proverb in the mouth of a fool. Verse 9, like a thorn that goes up into the hand of a drunkard, is a proverb in the mouth of a fool. Here's what it's saying. It's one thing to know truth, to be knowledgeable. It's another thing to know how to use it. It's another thing to know when to use it. It's another thing to know which moment to use it and which moment not to use it. Jane is going to lead us in a mental health seminar later today. I think one of the reasons I chose this topic today, I'm not going to talk about mental health here, both not facilitating fun, but most of all, because I know I would say things that would not be nearly as helpful. What Jane's going to say later on, and I don't want her to have to spend half her time cleaning up my mess. But I do think, if you have ever thought about positively and negatively, what is the relationship between faith and all this mental health stuff that's out there? Psychology, therapy, counseling, language of trauma, of depression, of all these personality disorders. What's the relationship? None of that's in the Bible. What do we do with that? Wisdom is a great category to put mental health in. You should know your Bible well. You should grow in knowledge of God's character and God's ways, but let me just say it very, very, very clearly, it is not enough to make a Bible. It is not enough to come to church regularly. You have to respond, you have to internalize, you need to pay attention not just to the Bible, but to the world around you. You need to pay attention not just to Hosea, but what's going on in your own emotions, your own reactions. You have to pay attention to how other people respond to you for better and worse, and recalibrate yourself. And so, here is a big difference, and here's one of my favorite examples. So it's going to be this later, I'm going to do it up front to kind of get us into the mindset of wisdom. In John chapter 11, it's a story I love, and I'll often, if you know me long enough, for me use this example. Jesus comes to Bethany, where there's a family that he knows very well and that he loves. Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. And Lazarus has just died. And Mary and Martha are his sisters, and they are grieving. And it is so easy to miss, but the way John tells the story, among other things, shows the wisdom of Jesus, which cannot be reduced to his knowledge of what's true. It's much more than that. Here are two sisters that are in the exact same situation. They have just lost the same brother. They both come up to Jesus in John 11, and they both say exactly the same words to Jesus. Jesus, if you had been here, my brother would not have. Jesus responds in two completely different ways to them. To the first sister, and I don't know what it is that Jesus knows about this woman as opposed to the other sister, or the tone in her voice as she said, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Maybe he heard despair. Maybe he heard rebellion and questioning against God. Maybe he heard something that I can't even imagine. But he heard something, and he knew her relationship. Paid attention to her enough over the years before that he knew that what she needed in response to that question, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died, is this: I am the resurrection and the life. Do you believe this? Not just that your brother will rise one day, but that I am the resurrection and the life. Do you believe this? And he responds to her overwhelming emotional negativity and despair with truth. Challenges how she's feeling. And he says, I and the resurrection of life. Then, 10 minutes later, an hour later, whatever it is, the next sister comes up, and she's also in tears, and she also is dealing with the exact same situation. Her brother Lazarus died, and she says the same exact thing. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And the next verse in the Bible is very famous. Jesus wept. That's his response. No words, empathy, weeping, entering into her suffering. And you could say, well, Jesus just like hired a truth and he wants to lean into him 20 minutes later. It's been a dream. But I think that's a bad reading. I think that he not only knows what's true, which people need empathy and compassion, people need to know what's true, but he also knows when to pull each one out and when not to pull each one out. Someone who is wisdom, who is wise, is someone who not only has knowledge, but knows how to use it, knows when to use it, and knows when not to use it. Knows which form of knowledge to bring to a situation, which principle to bring out when something happens. So wisdom is such a great, I think, an example of overall our series in this evening, that we don't just want to know the definition of vocab words theologically. We want to know how to use them. We want to know how to connect them to the rest of life. I've used this example before. I use it a lot in the future. I'm so convinced that Dietrich Bonhoeffer was right, that the great malady of Western Christianity is cheap grace. And so if you're a Christian, and you're theologically inclined, and like, oh, I can define grace, and I can define justice, and I can define mercy, and I can define this, it's one thing to define grace rightly, it's another thing to use it rightly. In response to your own sin, in response to other people's sin. Today is Father's Day, and so a whole lot of dads in our congregation. Yeah. One of the great challenges of being a parent is trying to figure out how to respond to the million moments you have with your kids as they grow up and they're confused and they're making mistakes and they're excited and they're surprising you. And knowing how to respond in the moment is so much more of a challenge and so much more significant than knowing in general that, A, you should make sure that you're consistent with your kids. You should make sure that they don't lie and cheat, steal and cheat. You should make sure that they know that you're careful. All those things are true. Pull out each one. How do you respond? That's what wisdom is for. And it's easy to know the definition of grace. It's harder to know when to use it and how to use it. And so in the bulletin, if you have it, I don't think I've ever done this yet. Right on the sermon, I've listed 7 C words. I might not get them today. If I don't, I'll come back to them next week. We're going to spend a couple of weeks on wisdom themes, including the fear of the Lord. If wisdom is a word that our culture uses as much outside of the church as we do inside of the church, and therefore we have to be careful, are we using it the way our culture uses it? Or are we using it the way our faith itself teaches us to use this language? The fear of the Lord is not language anybody can stop out of the church. It's hard to hear Christians using that language anymore. And so we'll come back to that in the near future. But that's a subset of wisdom. In this kind of breakdown you can see, I'm just going to make an argument, and I might not get to all of it today. Not that this is an exhaustive framework for wisdom, but I do think it's helpful. It's also always true that if you read a dictionary definition of any word, you've got to use a lot of other words to define a word. So we're going to learn some other words along the way. That wisdom is creational. Wisdom is covenantal. Wisdom is contextual. You already heard me kind of break that one up. Wisdom is not just knowing what's right and true. It's knowing what's needed in this particular moment. To put it this way, I'll come back to it very briefly later. Those who are wise are very good at improv. Improvisation is a skill the wise know. Improvisation is in between two extremes. If all of your dialogue is scripted for you ahead of time, you're not improvising, you're just reading, that's what people who love the Bible and love knowledge often fall into, which is, oh, here's a situation, you need to go read the Bible and see what it tells me to do. There's a million situations where that Bible will not tell you. You just cannot respond to so many moments in life with a pre-scripted script from God. On the other hand, improv is not making it up and doing whatever you want. Improv is reacting to a situation in a way that is neither prescripted, that's spontaneous, and yet also appropriate in light of what the situation is. Those who are wise are really good at improv. That is that they're contextual. Wisdom is contextual. The next one is that wisdom is curious. So those who are wise are curious. And talk about that for a bit. Wisdom is countercultural. You listen to the passage that Jonah read at the end, 1 Corinthians 1 in the beginning of 2, you should have heard a profound difference with the passages of 1 Kings and Proverbs. What is wise in the eyes of the world is foolish to God. What is weak and foolish in the eyes of the world is the wisdom and the power of God. True wisdom often looks foolish to our culture. True wisdom often looks like the opposite. Sense in our culture, and so there is a profoundly countercultural aspect of wisdom. Wisdom is correct, and what I mean by that is that if there is worldly wisdom, as James tells us, but also godly wisdom, how do you know the difference? And this is where we ultimately come back, Psalm 19, to the scriptures.
that when one person says this, and your own desires and instincts say this, and another moment in history says that, how do you know which one is wise? It's ultimately the fear of the Lord comes to God, what God has revealed, as the ultimate corrective lenses for what is actually wise. And in number seven, and maybe it'll be next week or a couple of weeks, we'll see, is wisdom is Christ centered. At the very end of the Sermon on the Mount, I'll come to this later, probably not today. The very end of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus, after saying all kinds of it, I could illustrate lots of things that he said here. Sermon on the Mount is profoundly kind to almost all of us. When somebody hits you, not only don't hit them back, ask them how you can bless them, even if you take a shirt off on back. When somebody wrongs you, bless them. When somebody curses you, pray for them. Don't be greedy. Give all that you have to the poor and lay up treasures in heaven. Everything the Sermon on the Mount says about sex, money, power, and enemies looks foolish to our culture. And at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus takes two pictures, and he's stealing them from the book of Proverbs. The book of Proverbs constantly talks about how these two women, we didn't get to read about them today, Lady Wisdom and Lady Foolishness, who are both there at the beginning of Proverbs, beseeching the son, who's about to come of age, to enter into a romantic relationship with them. They both have a house that they have built, and that they're inviting the son to come into. Wisdom builds a house, but so does folly. And at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says this, very end, I tell you, everyone who hears my words and does them, it's like a man or a woman, builds his house on the rock, a wise woman, who builds his house on the rock, no matter what crises and storms come, this house will stand. A person who hears my words but does not do them is like the fool who builds his house on the sand. And as soon as a catastrophe comes, the whole thing is upended. That is wisdom language for responding to Jesus. The New Testament writers constantly talk about how Jesus is the epitome of God's wisdom. Following Jesus is the epitome of our wisdom, imitating Jesus. And so let's look at a couple of these things. If you are in Proverbs, go back to Proverbs chapter 8, which is the second passage that Amy read. Wisdom is creation. I did a sermon in the last maybe 2 months or so on creation. Something I wanted to say there, I didn't, so I'll say it here. The older I get, the more I have a sense that one of our great mistakes as American Christians is that we functionally have no doctrine of creation. And by that, I don't mean that Christians don't believe that God created the world, but that what the doctrine of creation is actually doing, that we don't look at the world that way. We don't inhabit it. And so in Proverbs chapter 8, Amy read this starting in verse 22, wisdom as a woman is personified here in verses 22 to 31, basically says this, before anything else God created, the land, the sea, the weather elements, human beings, wisdom was there beside God before anything he created. And then there's always a debate over how you translate this, but the key is verse 30 and 31. I know we have some architects in here. Then I, wisdom, before anything was created, was beside God like a master worker, an architect, master craftsman, and I was daily God's delight, rejoicing before him always, rejoicing in his inhabited world, and delighting in the children of men. This poem is just basically saying in a personified way, something that scripture says a hundred other places, when God created the world, he created it by wisdom. So to speak, wisdom was the architect God consulted. Creation was not like, oops, I didn't intend to do that, but it just came out. It's not random. It's certainly not foolish. That creation doesn't just mean that there's stuff here and its origin is in God. It means that there's a blueprint and it's wise and there's order and there's rhyme and reason. One example I often use is when I was a teenager and I started growing some facial hair, this is a classic Father's Day thing, I remember when my dad taught me to shave. And you can shave with the grain of your face, or you can shave against it, cut yourself and get all kinds of pink kind of rashes on your face. But the world is like that. The world has ways of going with the grain of it, and has ways of going against the grain of it. If you tell the truth, you are fitting in with what God made you for. If you lie to other human beings, you are contradicting the put it this way, I'll come back to this later. Many even Christians, let alone like certainly just people in general in our culture, even if they believe in God, and they believe that the origin, temporally and spatially, of everything that we see and touch is in God, we often functionally treat the world as if it's still formless and void. We're the ones who give it meaning. We're the ones who give it shape. We're the ones who decide how we operate in the sphere, and that's not true. If you go back to Proverbs chapter 3, notice how explicitly it said, verse 19 and 20, the Lord by wisdom founded the earth. By understanding, he established the heavens. By his knowledge, the deeps broke open and the clouds dropped down the dew. It is central to the biblical writers that when God created the world, wisdom is the main category of understanding. It took place a profound act of wisdom. It makes sense. It has purpose. It's not random. It's not to be regretted. It's not meaningless. It's not absurd. It's not arbitrary. There is wisdom there. If like you heard Andy read the first passage in 1 Kings 4, you're like, this is a really random passage. It is. And I encourage you to go back and read it later on. But it's about Solomon. We've heard the wisdom language a couple of times in there. But I want you to notice that in 1 Kings 4, two things are emphasized about fleshing out. What does it mean that Solomon was the wisest of all people in the present until he goes off the rails and gone early in his life? What does it mean? And two things are emphasized in that passage. One is that because Solomon was wise, there was unbelievable blessing and flourishing in the kingdom. Everybody was sitting under their own fig tree. There was peace. Everybody had more than they needed. Wisdom endows human beings to bless the world, and it also says that Solomon had dominion over all the other kingdoms around him and the rule over the world the way it was supposed to assume it fits. But the other thing I said, and this is the really weird part, is Solomon wrote about cedar trees, and he wrote about reptiles and birds and insects and all this stuff. And one, it's like, that's a weird series of topics to write about. And two, if you go to Proverbs, there's not really much in there about cedar trees and reptiles and insects. And so what is it saying there? And what it's saying is this. What it means that Solomon is wise is that he saw what God made and he understood what was good. All these creational categories, Solomon saw them, he observed them, and he wrote about what they mean and what they're for. Those who are wise see the contours of creation, see what God made the world for, and they fit themselves in. You don't need to turn here, but one of many other places, Psalm 104, as it surveys everything God has created, towards the end it says this, O Lord, how manifold are your works in wisdom. You have made them all. The sea is full of your creatures. Let me give a counter example. My wife Helen can tell you this. I am one of my many, many, many forms of folly and immaturity is that if I get behind the wheel of the car, I honk really quickly when somebody does something dumb. I complain and moan constantly about how the stoplight systems make no sense. This one goes green, right as the other one goes red. And I'm constantly bemoaning how foolish this traffic system in Manhattan and New York City is. Now, I actually think that's kind of true. I think my response to that is not helpful. I actually do think that what human beings make is authentically foolish. The world's not different. The world is different. You're breathing right now, and it's actually possible for you to breathe. Later on, you're going to be hungry, you're going to be food, please. You're going to be lonely, and all the other human beings are going to be, the world is what it's supposed to be, at least in some ultimate sense. The world makes sense. The world has order. It's not formless and void. Wisdom is a creational category. Alvaro Donovan puts it this, Christians ought to understand creation not merely or mainly as the raw material out of which the world as we know it was originally composed, but primarily as the order and coherence in which it was composed. He goes on and says, the order of things that God has made, wisdom is an architect, there's a blueprint. Later on today, you could walk around this massive building and you could, you know, walk right into a door, you could walk into this and bang your knee, or you could respond to and adapt to the way the architect made this building and walk through it, submitting to the designs of the architect. Those who are wise walk through the world paying attention to the blueprint, doing what the architect designed, which was wise. And so it's all of life. And so Oliver Adonai goes on, the order of things that God's made is there, it is objective, and humanity has a place within it. Christian ethics, therefore, has an objective reference because it is concerned with human beings' lives in accordance with this order of creation. The way the universe is determines how human beings ought to live. It's the essence of wisdom. What God made the world for? Here is another one of 8,000 forms of my own folly. Every once in a while, I'll buy something from IKEA, and I am, this will not surprise you, I am such an abstract thinker, and I will read the directions, and I will look at the picture, and I'll be like, this makes no sense. This is wrong. What's wrong with this thing? And yet, when I go astray from what IKEA tells me to do, I always end up realizing, after it's too late, I have put things together wrongly. This bookshelf actually doesn't work. This chair actually doesn't work. You have to follow the instructions by which the design, the blueprint, the deck. And so wisdom is creation. Psalm 19 at the beginning of our service. And so I would say this. On the one hand, one of the reasons you can't just know the Bible, you can know the Bible better than any other human being has ever known. You don't and you won't, but you could. And you can still be absolutely foolish. You have to pay attention to the world. Have your eyes open. Maybe you can tell us in a minute. Be curious about the world. Maybe open to notice what's like, what's not like. And the essence of foolishness. I was very aware getting ready for this sermon. Hopefully I don't usually do this. If I do, please come up and tell me afterwards. I don't want to come across as just giving like a negative diatribe of our culture here. But I do think there are many ways in which our culture, not unique, but it's true of every culture in the history of the world, the fallen world, but there are many ways in which our culture encourages us to be foolish rather than wise. And here I think is the central one. I'll come to this in a bit, a little more. Our culture encourages us to start with our desires, start with our experience, and to work out towards the world, and that's the opposite. Wisdom starts with what the world is like, and then tries to adapt, tries to respond, tries to be in tune. And so wisdom is creational, above and beyond everything else. Second is covenantal, and I mean a couple of things. We'll talk about this next week. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. High IQ is not the beginning of wisdom. Street smarts are not the beginning of wisdom. An Ivy League degree is not the beginning of wisdom. Having a great childhood or a terrible childhood is not the beginning of wisdom. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Those who relate rightly to God in covenant will relate rightly to everything he's made. Those who relate wrongly to the Creator will end everything. Wisdom is a covenantal relational category. At the very beginning of Proverbs 1, it says, yes, those who are wise have insight, and they have EQ and IQ, and they pay attention to things. That they also care about righteousness, justice, and ethics. They care about the poor. They care about the creator. And that has nothing to do in and of itself with having a good childhood, bad childhood, get high IQ, low IQ, whatever it is. It's one of the many reasons that while the wicked and the foolish are not completely identical with the righteous and the wicked, they are strongly overlapped. There is no one who is wise who is not also righteous. There is no one who is wicked who is not also foolish. These two categories always connect, even if they ultimately look at it a bit different. Here is something I pull out every once in a while on this category. Lots of ways you can read the Harry Potter novels. Love the Harry Potter novels. I always say I remember reading them, the Python in earnest, listening to them on the audiobook. So great. Here is one of many ways you could read or reread in the future, the Harry Potter novels, that they are a story parallel to Proverbs of a wise man and a foolish man. Albus Dumbledore and Voldemort. And three kids, Harry, Hermione, and Ron, who are neither at the beginning, but are like the sun, simple. You ever read Proverbs? Not just two kinds of people, the wise and the foolish. There's also the simple, that is those who have not yet chosen a path. And Dumbledore says in one novel to the kids who are trying to figure out, am I going to go this way? Am I going to go this way? Wisdom must provide counsel that is consistent with what is good, not just effective, not just successful. Knowledge severed from goodness is too dangerous for human beings, and even foolish can almost certainly fail. I think ultimately the difference between Dumbledore and Voldemort, you don't have to be that far, I haven't seen that in the last 20 years, and then he has a great experience to tell the college. If you haven't read this yet. The difference between Dumbledore and Voldemort is not that one is more gifted than the other, not that one is smarter or dumber than the other. It's that one, Voldemort, thinks that the worst possible thing is not getting what he wants, death, and he's willing to cross any boundary to avoid death. And Dumbledore believes that some things are worse than death, and he's willing to suffer not to cross the boundaries. The difference is not IQ, the difference is not skill, the difference is wisdom versus folly. There are some things Dumbledore will not do because he knows it's not what the world is for, and there is nothing that Voldemort is going to do if it will let him. So wisdom is covenantal. Those who are wise have a deep sense of being beholden to something greater, older, bigger, and more beautiful than their own desires. They are beholden to something bigger going on in the universe, and they keep covenant with those purposes. They dictate what they do. Because I already did this, I'm not going to come back to this one, but it's contextual. It's not just that he knows right and wrong, righteousness, unrighteousness, justice, injustice. But you know how to respond. You know how to apply it. One of the really hard things about being a human being is that every situation you will ever walk into has already gone wrong before you show up. How you respond to family members, friends, work environments, and other sinners, never in an ideal setting, the way the world is supposed to be, is incredibly hard. Why do I bring a certain tone of voice in this moment? Do I bring a gentle tone of voice in this moment? Do I emphasize mercy and compassion here? Do I emphasize that's not okay and that can't be tolerated here? It is really hard to do. Not that those are the only two options, but knowing how to respond is really hard. And so with these three, wisdom is creational, it's covenantal, and it's contextual. Here is my definition. I'm going to wrap up pretty soon. We'll come back to this next. Here is my definition of wisdom. Wisdom is, one, the perception of the order that God made the world. It looks at it, so that's a door. You're supposed to walk out of it. And this is the pew. You're supposed to sit in there. I don't decide as I show up what these are for. Wisdom is the perception. Pews are for sitting in. Doors are for walking. Food is for eating. Sex is for marriage. Money is for serving other people, not having a sense of security for the future, so you don't have to trust God. There are things that all this stuff is for, and there are ways to use the moment. And wisdom is first the perception of what all of these things are. The wise perceive where this goes. They perceive what it's for. But if that's as far as it goes, they're only knowledgeable. They're not wise. So second, wisdom is participation. Actually sitting, it's actually only having sex in marriage. It's actually using your money to bless other people just to keep on being met, rather than buying a third and a fourth home and saving and saving and saving and saving so they can feel good about the future. It's actually participating in that order. And then third, it's actually knowing how to practically apply which one goes where as each moment comes up. What do I need to do here? What do I need to do there? The wise perceive God's order in the world. They participate in God's order in the world. And they know how to practically apply God's order to every situation. If you are not feeling very wise right now, welcome to the talk. There is a reason that we all start off foolish, that we all need to learn how to be wise. And so let me end with this last one today and one of the other ones next week. The wisdom is curious. You might hear everything I've said so far, and think, man, wise. They just know what's going on. And there is a sense of general know what's going on, but the wise are actually, this might surprise you, much more likely to be aware and to admit, I have no idea what's going on in this situation. I have no idea what God wants me to do here. I have no idea how to do that well. And so the wise are much more open to learning than the fools are, according to wisdom literature. They're much more open to being rebuked and corrected and changing course than fools are. The wise are open to having course correction by running into things, by hearing from other people. Abraham Heschel is a very famous Jewish theologian here in New York City in the middle of the 20th century. He's a good friend of Martin Luther King Jr. during the civil rights movement. He protested the Vietnam War. He taught at Jewish Theological Seminary up near Columbia in West Harlem. And he said, here's the great difference between wisdom and foolishness. Fools see what they already know. The wise know what they see. Fools are constantly reacting to moments, being like, I already know that, I already know that, I already know that. One of my favorite Twitter accounts, because it just cracks me up every time, but I think it's also some content. I forget on my head exactly what it's called, but it's something along the lines of, amazingly, the latest current event confirms all my political priors, a priorities. And it basically just collects all of these statements on Twitter where something happens in the news and people respond to it, told it, and roll their eyes at everybody who didn't hit. And the fool's posture towards reality is constantly rolling your eyes at other people who don't get it, constantly being like, aha, I knew it. This situation confirms what I already suspect. And you're not curious. One of the things, here's the way that I put it, and I would encourage you to use this as a litmus test for yourself. Those who are wise are capable of wonder and astonishment. All those who are foolish can't be surprised by them. They can't be surprised by the world anymore. They just see same old, same old, same old. And the real history is just unwinding as one perpetual proof that I'm already smarter than everyone else. Those who are wise are curious about the world. I would say that when we use the word ideology in a negative way, this is why we're using it there. Ideology is when you come to situations with pre-commitments that you're not going to move away from. I already know what's going on here. I already know what the problem is. I already know what the solution is. In the latest situation, this gives me an opportunity to open my mouth and to say it for the 10,000. It's not saying that the wise show up neutral, not knowing anything, but the wise are open to seeing things they haven't seen yet, to not just seeing one pattern over and over and over again. The wise are open to wonder. I have never seen the show, but I really strongly suspect that the reason Ted Lasso has become so popular is because it hits on this. In a culture of cynicism, in a culture of constant judgmentalism, in a culture of know-it-alls who are sad and depressed, and make everybody else sad and depressed every time they talk about how dumb everybody else, that Ted Lasso is this character who, like himself, is constantly trying to encourage people to be curious and not judgmental, to be open to wonder and surprise, and not just roll your eyes. That all the priors are confirmed by the most recent days of events again. And so here is, and not because he has low IQ, he was much smarter than I am, not because of anything in his background, but just because he ultimately postured himself wrongly to his creator and therefore became poor. Here is, I think, the most blatant ideology, the most blatant mission statement of the posture of the fool. This is Friedrich Nietzsche. Nietzsche says this: no one gives human beings or the world their faults. Neither God, nor society, nor their parents or ancestors, nor even the person themselves. No person is responsible for the world or humans being there at all. Humans are not the effect of some special purpose, of a will, of an act. There is no purpose. There is no purpose. It is absurd to wish to devolve one's essence onto some end or other. We have invented the concept of an end. In reality, there is no purpose, there is no goal. The inquiry goes, ultimately, human beings find nothing in things except what we ourselves have afforded. still formless and void. The wise pay attention to what God has said. Pay attention to what the order is. Dorothy Sayers put this in this way in The Mind of the Master. The popular mind in our culture has become so confused that it is no longer able to receive any statement of fact except as an expression of personal feeling, preference, and desire. And so ultimately the wise are those who pay attention to God's order, they perceive it, they respond to it, participate in it, they know how to apply it. Because I got a little behind and didn't get to all this in the commentary, I do want to end in a place that makes sense. And so in the book of Job, Job is, and by the way, there are four books in our Old Testament that are Proverbs, which is wisdom in general, the book of Job, which is how to respond to not just suffering, suffering that makes no sense. We'll look at that later. Ecclesiastes, how do you respond to perpetual disappointment? I pursued pleasure, that didn't pan out. I pursued money, that was really disappointing. I pursued power, didn't make the world better, and you're constantly running into dead ends. And you're constantly, as you get older, whether it's a straight line, you can guess, with more knowledge and more wisdom comes more sorrow. I did not become cynical and despairing. Ecclesiastes is what wisdom looks like in response to that. And Song of Songs is what wisdom looks like to sex in relationships. In the middle of Job, in Job 28, you can look at it later, Job comes to the end of his rope. He knows his friends are foolish. God is not speaking. And Job cannot understand anything that is happening to himself or to the world. And he asks a question over and over in Job 28. Where shall wisdom be found? Where shall wisdom be found? And I'll say this as we go on to the Lord's table. The essence of Christianity's answer to that is not just Jesus, but in Jesus' death and resurrection. Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection, and committing your life to this person, to die for our sins, who rose again from the dead, following him, imitating him, by the Spirit, becoming more like him, is the where you ultimately get your friends. Where shall wisdom be found in the one who rules for us? Who died for us, who rose for us. Ultimately, wisdom means following Jesus. Ultimately, wisdom means taking up your cross, sacrificing anything, denying anything that gets in the way of that, and putting that first in your life. Jesus is the wisdom of God. I think it is significant as we go to the Lord's table right now that in I was sending this to Mary Sue and a few others came along recently. Whenever there are modern novels that take Jesus as a figure and they put him in a later time and place, and I want us to go into the Lord's table. Have you got this? You know, the Brothers Karamazov or Dostoevsky has Jesus show up during the Spanish Inquisition. Dorothy Sayers, The Man Born to be King, which just shows up in modern Britain. And there's many other plays and stories where Jesus shows up. The same Jesus in the Gospels at a later time. That the thing they always have in common, and I think rightly so, is that every culture, every society, every moment ends up crucifying them again. That is what that means. We would too. I would. And so ultimately, as we come to the Lord's table, this is the repeat what Jonah read in 1 Corinthians 1. In the eyes of the world, the death of Jesus, the story of Jesus being the key to anything else, is both foolishness and weakness. But to us who are called, Jews and Gentiles, high IQ, low IQ, rich, poor, men, women, every race, every culture, to us who are being called, power of God, so as you hold these elements and as you take them, this is wisdom. You see it. You see that this is the moment it all gets healed. This is the moment when it all comes back together. This is the moment when what a human being is supposed to be like comes on the scene. This is the moment when what God is like is shown to us more believers.